Welcome to the first ever episode of Bailey's Bridges. I'm so excited. My name is Dr. Tiffany Bailey Sloan. I'm a licensed clinical psychologist and licensed funeral professional. And I have been here in the mountains of eastern Kentucky for a long, long time. My parents started in 1968. So first of all, I want to start by saying thank you for choosing to spend a little time with me today. So excited. Anyways, let's get right to it. Whether you have recently lost somebody you love or you're trying to support somebody who's grieving, I hope you leave each episode of Bailey's Bridges feeling a little more understood, a little more hopeful, and maybe even a little less alone. So the name Bailey's Bridges was chosen very intentionally. Grief has a way of making us feel stranded between two worlds. One is the life we knew before our loss, and the other is the life that we're slowly learning to live without someone that we love. And no, there's no bridge that can erase this distance, but sometimes the bridge can help us cross it, okay? That's my hope for this podcast. I do not give easy answers. My purpose is not to explain away pain. My purpose is to build bridges between psychology and everyday life, between research and real people. Okay. So today I want to begin with a very simple question, but one that I think most people have never really stopped to ask. Why do funerals matter? The question is not why do we have one, not how should one be planned, but why have human beings in every single culture throughout history felt compelled to stop what they're doing, gather, and create rituals around death? Think about that for just a moment. Long before they were funeral homes, cemeteries, churches, before psychology, people have always buried their dead, or at least had some kind of funeral ritual for their dead. They gathered, remembered, cried, told stories. They did something that marked the moment. But why? Because something inside us seems to know that when someone we love dies, doing nothing at all doesn't feel right. I've often wondered if our hearts understood something centuries before science ever found the words to explain it. One of the things I love about psychology is that it often gives language to things that people have known intuitively all along. Research doesn't usually invent any kind of truth. It just offers something explanations to why that we've been doing some of the things that we've done for generations and why that works. And that's exactly what has happened with funeral rituals. So over the last several decades, psychologists, they've spent countless hours studying grief. They've looked at what helps people adjust after loss. They've examined why some people find healthy ways to carry their grief while others become stuck. They've explored the importance of relationships and community and storytelling and meaning. And what they've discovered is fascinating, but it's pretty simple. The very things that grief research now tells us are so important are the very things that funeral rituals have quietly been providing throughout history. Not because someone designed funerals around psychology, but because human beings have always been trying to care for broken hearts. That's something I witness almost every day. I've sat with families moments after they've learned that someone that they love has died, and I've watched people struggle to find words that simply don't exist. Those moments, you know, I've seen grown men cry over their mamas. And in those moments, grief isn't just emotional. It's physical, it's mental, it's spiritual. It affects every part of who we are. And one of the things that we now understand about grief is that it doesn't simply break our hearts. It disrupts our entire world. And routines that once felt automatic suddenly become hard. Time feels strange. concentration disappears. People often they tell me that they can't even remember conversations that they had an hour or two earlier. Others say like they feel like they're watching their life happen from outside of themselves. They describe feeling numb or overwhelmed by emotions that seem to change from 1 minute to the next. And every one of those reactions is normal, because when we lose somebody that's deeply connected to our lives, our brains aren't just processing the information. They're actually trying to reorganize an entire world that no longer looks the way it did yesterday. And that's a tremendous amount of work, which is why I don't think funerals exist primarily for the person who's died. I think they've always existed for those who have to keep on living. And that may sound strange from coming from a funeral director. Funerals certainly honor the life of the person that we've lost, and they should, because every life deserves to be remembered, every story deserves to be told, every person deserves dignity. But I believe something equally important is happening. The funeral is quietly beginning the healing of everyone left behind. And that healing doesn't happen because grief disappears. It happens because grief has finally found somewhere to go. And one of our needs, psychological needs, is making the impossible seem or feel real. So I want you to picture something with me, okay? You've probably seen it before. The funeral home is quiet. The family's gathering. No one's talking very much. Friends begin arriving one by one. Somebody signs the register book. Another person places flowers beside the casket. There's some hugs, a few whispered words, and then almost everyone does the same thing. They walk slowly toward the casket. Some stand there only a few seconds, and others stay a much longer time. Some gently touch a hand, or some straighten a tie or smooth a strand of hair, and some quietly whisper words that nobody else can hear. But then they step away. And then a few minutes later, they find themselves walking back again. Have you ever noticed that? Like, people approach the casket they rarely approach the casket just once. And I've seen this happen hundreds of times over the years. And I used to wonder, back a long time ago, I used to wonder why. If they've already seen their loved one, why do they keep going back, right? But as a funeral director and a psychologist, I've come to believe and really know in my heart that it's because our hearts and minds process loss at different speeds. So our minds understand the facts of death remarkably fast. Someone tells us, you know, your dad died. Oh, we understand that sentence. We understand those words, right? But emotionally, our hearts often whisper, that can't be true. And one of the remarkable things that we've learned about grief is that acceptance isn't a single moment. It's something that happens because it's not something that happens because someone tells us the news, right? Acceptance is usually a gradual process, and our minds and our emotions slowly begin catching up with one another over time. And that's why people often describe the first days after a death as feeling very unreal. Have you ever heard somebody say, like, I know he's gone, but it doesn't feel real yet? Almost every grieving family says some version of those words. And they're not in denial. They're experiencing something completely human. The relationship that they've built over the years, or even decades, that doesn't simply disappear because our loved one has died. Their brain still expects to hear the familiar voice, see the familiar face, receive that phone call that has always come every Sunday afternoon. Psychologists sometimes talk about our brains constantly making predictions about the world around us. Every day, without us even realizing it, our minds expect certain people to be where they've always been. We expect mom to answer the phone. We expect dad to be sitting in his chair. We expect our spouse to walk through the front door after work. Then suddenly, death interrupts those expectations. And our mind knows what happened, but our hearts haven't caught up to that yet. And that's one reason meaningful funeral rituals matter so much, because they gently help bridge that gap, not by forcing reality on us, but by allowing us to encounter it little by little by little. So when someone chooses to view their loved one, they aren't simply looking at a body. They're allowing one more part of themselves to begin accepting something that their heart still struggles to believe. Now notice that I said when someone chooses, and I think that's important because no one should ever feel pressured to view a loved one. Every grief journey is different. Every death is different. There are situations involving trauma and illness and personal preference where viewing may not be appropriate or it may not be helpful for a particular family. So grief doesn't come with this checklist. There's no right or wrong way to say goodbye. But when viewing's possible, and here's the main point, when it is meaningful, when it feels meaningful to you, okay, that's what's important. I've watched it become, when it is meaningful, I've watched it become one of the quietest acts of courage that a family can take. Sometimes it's a wife resting her hand on her husband's shoulder for one last time, or it's a grandson placing Papa's favorite pocket knife beside him, or a little girl slipping a drawing into her grandma's hands because she wants Mama to have it, right? Those moments aren't about pretending death didn't happen. They are allowing love one final opportunity to express itself, because love has always needed somewhere to go. And that's something I wish more people understood about the funeral service. The work we do really isn't about preparing someone for a visitation. It's about preparing the family for one of the most difficult moments of their lives. And when a family says, you know, he looks peaceful, they're usually, or he looks better than he's looked in 5 years, they're usually talking about much more than appearance. What they're talking about is recognition. They're talking about replacing the final images of illness and pain or trauma with something that more closely reflects the person that they loved for years. They're saying, that's the face I know. And as a funeral director, those are some of the most meaningful words I could ever hear, not because I've accomplished anything, but because I know what they're really telling me. And they're telling me that the family has been given one less obstacle to carry in their grief. Because funerals do not create grief. They create a safe space where the reality and the love can finally meet, where those two concepts can finally come together. Okay. And this, another grief need is we're never meant to grieve alone. We were never meant, that wasn't how it was meant to be. And there's something that has always fascinated me, particularly about mountain communities, is when someone dies in mountain communities, people don't wait to be asked for help. They just come. They just show up before the obituary is even finished. Somebody's already putting a pot of coffee on. The neighbor walks through the back door carrying a casserole wrapped in an aluminum foil, right? Somebody's, you know, mowing your yard for you, or there's a church member answering the telephone, or you know, there's all these acts of servitude and kindness, right? The women in the kitchen, they're making sure nobody goes hungry. And if you grew up in Appalachia, none of that seems unusual. Actually, if it didn't happen, we would probably wonder what was wrong. And I've heard people from outside our region ask, like, why do people keep bringing food? The family's probably not even hungry. Well, they're right. Most families aren't hungry. Grief has a way of taking your appetite with it. But there's the beautiful thing. The food was never just about feeding the stomach. It was about feeding something much deeper. You see, one of the first casualties of grief is our sense of safety. And most people spend our lives believing that the people we love will be there tomorrow, not because we've consciously thought about that, but because our brains quietly depend on that assumption. And when death suddenly shatters it, the world can feel very unpredictable overnight. And people often describe feeling completely untethered, like the ground beneath them has shifted. And as psychologists, we know when people experience overwhelming stress or trauma, one of the most healing things another human being can offer is not advice. It's not advice. It's presence. And we call that co-regulation. It's a fancy psychological term for something that our grandparents have practiced without ever needing any kind of fancy vocabulary for it, that's for sure. But our nervous systems calm in the presence of people who make us feel safe. I mean, think about a frightened child. What's the first thing they usually do? They reach for someone, right? Not because that person can magically erase whatever frightened them, but because they instinctively know that they're safer together than alone. Grief doesn't change that. In many ways, it amplifies it. Even as adults, we still need people. Maybe that's why I've rarely seen someone leave a visitation saying, "I am so glad that I handled this all by myself." We don't hear that. Instead, what I hear is something very, very different. "I had no idea how many people loved Dad. I didn't realize how many lives that she had touched. Seeing everybody come here meant more to me than I could ever explain." And those aren't just sentimental comments. They're moments of healing, because grief has the tendency to narrow our world. And when someone dies, our attention naturally focuses on everything that we've lost. It's the empty chair, the silent phone, the bedroom that feels too quiet, the routine that no longer exists. But then something remarkable happens during a visitation. One person steps forward and says, "Your mom was my favorite Sunday school teacher." And somebody else may say, "Your dad gave me my first job." Someone else remembers a time that your grandmother took food to their family when they had nothing. And then suddenly, the story gets bigger. The family begins seeing pieces of their loved one's life that they never knew. They're reminded that while they've lost someone deeply personal, the world hasn't forgot this person. And that's an incredibly powerful psychological experience, because every one of us wants to know that people that we loved matter, not just to us, but to the world around them. And I've often thought that the visitation line was one of the most underrated parts of a funeral. From the outside, it can look very repetitive, right? Handshake after handshake, hug after hug, "I'm sorry for your loss. I'm praying for you." But if you stand there long enough, something else begins to happen. Each person adds another brushstroke to this portrait of the person who died. One remembers their generosity. The other remembers their sense of humor. Another remembers their faith, their work ethic, their kindness, their stubbornness. Even the stories that make everybody laugh, little by little, a life begins taking shape, not through one person's memory, but through an entire community. And as a psychologist, I find that fascinating, because identity has never belonged to just one person. Part of who we are lives inside the memories of everyone whose life that we've touched. And one of the quiet gifts of a funeral is that those memories are returned to the family. It's like the community saying, you knew one part of him, but let me show you another. Or you knew her as your mother, but let me tell you what she meant to me. And you see, that's an incredible gift. And then there are the hugs. And you know, I've had people apologize for crying when they walk through the visitation line, as if the tears somehow make other people uncomfortable. And I usually smile and tell them something that I believe with all my heart, is that tears are one of the languages of love. They don't need translating. Everybody understands tears. Sometimes the most healing thing another person can do isn't find the perfect words. Sometimes it's simply placing the hand on the shoulder, holding your hand, crying with you. There is something profoundly healing about realizing that somebody else's heart hurts because yours does. And that's compassion in its purest form. And maybe that's why our Appalachian communities have always understood something that we've only recently begun to describe in psych literature. And healing doesn't happen because someone tells us to be strong. Healing begins when somebody quietly says, you don't have to carry this by yourself. And after a family begins to discover that they aren't alone, something else almost always begins to happen. The room, like I said, the room slowly fills with stories. Some bring tears, some bring laughter. Some stories the family's heard 1,000 times, and others they've never heard before. But as it turns out, those stories aren't just memories. They're helping answer one of the deepest questions that grief leaves behind. And that's, will this person's life continue to matter now that they're gone? And so that's kind of where we go next is, as far as psychological needs, is we need to know that life still matters, that their life mattered. One of my favorite moments at any visitation usually happens when someone says, do you remember the time? Almost immediately, everybody turns and leans in. Sometimes the story's hilarious, and maybe someone remembers Papa accidentally driving a tractor into a creek or something like that. Mama carrying food to feed 3 families after every single Sunday after church. Some kind of practical joke that somebody played for 40 solid years that still made everybody laugh somehow. But just for a few moments, the room changes. The tears are still there, but now they're sharing space with smiles. And I always loved those moments. Not because they distract us from grief, but because they remind us that grief and joy have never, ever been enemies. They've always walked together. You see, one of the greatest fears that people have after somebody dies is that over time they'll slowly disappear, right? Not physically. They understand that's already happened, but disappear from memory, from conversation, from the lives of the people they loved. And I don't think that, I don't think that's something that we talk about enough. Grief isn't only the fear of living without somebody. Sometimes it's the fear that the world will eventually forget that they were ever here, and that's why stories matter. Every story says that this life made a difference. You know, I often think of stories as like these little containers. They carry pieces of a person that death can never touch. They can never touch a voice, a laugh, a habit, a lesson or value or a favorite saying, a way of looking at the world. Every time we tell those stories, we carry those pieces forward. And I think our Appalachian communities have always understood this. We aren't known for reading these long biographies at funerals. Most of the time, we're storytellers, right? And if you've ever sat in a church fellowship hall after a funeral, you know exactly what I'm talking about. Someone starts one story, and that reminds somebody else of another story. And before long, the entire table's laughing, and then they're crying, and then they're laughing again. And it's almost impossible to tell where one memory ends and the other begins. To someone walking by, it might sound like ordinary conversation, but in reality, something extraordinary is happening. The family is slowly rebuilding the picture of the person that they lost. Because, okay, so here's what illness can do. Like someone who battled Alzheimer's. Sometimes that's all the people remember. If somebody spent months in the hospital, those final weeks can actually overshadow 80 beautiful years. If somebody died after a difficult illness, the disease can become bigger than the life that they lived. And funerals gently push back against that through display tables and photographs and maybe a favorite fishing pole, a coal miner's helmet, a well-worn Bible, a homemade quilt. They all whisper the same thing. This person was so much more than the way that they died. And I can't tell you how many times I've watched grandchildren walk over to a display table and suddenly say, I forgot Papa used to carry that pocket knife everywhere. Or, I haven't seen Mom's recipe book in years. So those things aren't just objects. They're doorways. They open memories that grief was trying to bury beneath pain. And modern grief research has helped us understand something that previous generations often misunderstood. Because for years, people believed that healthy grieving meant letting go, moving on, finding closure, which if you know me at all, you know I do not like that word at all. Closure, I think, is misleading. But because those terms, when you say them, it's almost as if healing requires us to loosen our emotional connection to the person who died. And today, we understand grief very differently. Healthy grieving isn't about ending a relationship, but it is about changing it. Because love doesn't stop because somebody dies. It simply has to find a new way to exist. And I think one of the most comforting things that psychology has discovered is that. If you've ever found yourself making your mother's biscuits exactly the way she taught you to, or catching yourself using one of your father's favorite expressions, or smiling because your granddaughter laughs exactly like her grandmother, you're not grieving incorrectly. You're actually doing something profoundly human. The people we love continue shaping who we become, not because that we refuse to accept their death, but because relationships do not end when the breathing does. They continue through memory, values, traditions, stories, through the lives that we continue living because they first live theirs. And in psychology, sometimes we refer to this as maintaining a continuing bond. And I actually like that phrase because it's exactly what it feels like. We're not holding on so tightly that we can't live. And we're not letting go so completely that we forget. Instead, we're learning how to carry someone with us as we keep walking forward. When I think about Appalachia, I realize we've been doing this for generations. Every time somebody makes Mamaw's apple butter, right? Every Decoration Day when families climb up the hillside to clean the graves and place the flowers and tell the kids about stories about relatives that they never had the chance to meet. Every time a favorite hymn is sung, oh, Daddy loved that song. We're saying something beautiful. We're saying, your life still reaches us. Your love is still changing us. You're still part of this family. And I have to tell you, I think there's something incredibly hopeful about that. Because the opposite of grief is not forgetting. The opposite of grief is remembering so well that love continues finding new ways to live. Of course, not every memory comes through words. Sometimes it comes through music. Sometimes it's one familiar hymn that says every single thing that our hearts have been trying to express all day long. And if you've ever sat in a little church, a little mountain church, while lined out singing, echoed through the sanctuary, you already know what I'm talking about. There's some of the that's some of the emotions that words alone were never meant to carry. So sometimes our heart sings before it can speak. There are some moments in life when words simply aren't enough. Have you ever noticed that? Like someone walks through a visitation line and says, "I'm so sorry," and you know they mean it, and you appreciate it, but somehow those words cannot quite reach the place that's hurting. And it's not because that they said the wrong thing. It's because there's really not any perfect words. Grief has a way of taking us beyond language. And it's fascinating. Our brains are remarkably good at organizing thoughts into words when life makes sense. But grief doesn't make any sense. And it overwhelms the very parts of us that can actually help us explain what we're feeling. So that's why so many grieving people tell me, I don't even know how to put this into words. And they're not struggling because they're not intelligent. They're struggling because love and loss are experiences that often live deeper than language. And maybe that's why music has always been part of funerals, not just here in Appalachia, but across cultures and throughout all of history. People instinctively sang. I started paying a little closer attention to this at one point, and I want you to think about the last funeral that you attended. Can you remember the message? Maybe. Can you remember who was there? Probably some of them. But chances are you can remember that music. Maybe it was the Old Rugged Cross or Amazing Grace or Beulah Land. Or maybe it was Lay My Crown at the Master's Feet, which is one of my favorites. Or perhaps it was one of those old mountain hymns that seems to echo through the hollers long after the last note has faded away. Isn't that interesting, though? Years later, the song remains, and with it, the memory. And that's because music is one of the most powerful ways that our brains store emotional experiences. A single melody can unlock memories that have been quietly resting for decades. And you've probably experienced that yourself. You're driving down the road, a song or an old hymn comes on the radio, and you're suddenly right back in your grandma's church. You can smell the wooden pews. You can remember who was sitting beside you. You can remember the preacher's voice. All because of a song. Music has that kind of power. It bypasses the part of us that's trying to explain everything. And it goes straight to the heart. And I think that's one reason why music has always been woven into grief. Sometimes the heart sings long before it knows how to speak. And here in the mountains, our music tells a story all on its own. You know, I talked about the lined out singing. It's one of those things that it's kind of difficult to describe. One voice begins, and it's not polished perfection. It's not with a choir. It's not with instruments. It's just one voice, slow and deliberate, calling out each line. And then almost like a wave rolling across the mountains, the congregation joins in. And not everybody sings the same note, and not everybody enters at exactly the same time. Some voices are strong, some are frail, some are beautifully off-key. But somehow, together, they create something breathtaking. And every time I hear it, I cannot help but to think, that's kind of what grief sounds like. Because no two people grieve exactly alike. They carry their sorrow loudly, some of them. Some of them almost whisper it. Some break down immediately. Others sit quietly for weeks before the tears come. There's different voices. There's different rhythms, journeys. Yet somehow, when we're willing to grieve together, our individual voice becomes something larger than ourselves. And that's exactly what lined out singing does. No one carries the song alone. The congregation carries it together, and that is such a beautiful picture of mourning. And I think one of the greatest misconceptions about grief is that we're supposed to control it, keep it together, stay strong, don't let people see us cry. And I honestly wish I could retire all those phrases, because tears are not evidence that we're falling apart. They're evidence that love mattered. And music gives those tears somewhere safe to land. I can't tell you how many times that I've watched somebody sit quietly through an entire visitation. They've greeted visitors. They've answered questions. They've thanked people for coming. They've held themselves together because they felt like they needed to be strong for everybody else. Right? And then the pianist starts playing one familiar hymn. And the grandson starts singing the song his grandmother loved. And suddenly, what happens? The tears come. And I've seen people apologize in those moments. I was doing so good until they sang that song. I usually smile because I don't think they were falling apart at all. I think they had finally found a place where their grief felt safe enough to come out. And sometimes healing begins not when we stop crying, but when we finally allow ourselves to. One of the things Appalachian funerals have always done well is make room for emotion. There's room for tears. There's room for silence, for prayer, for laughter, for testimonies, for songs that have been passed down from one generation to the next. And nobody expects grief to fit neatly into this single emotion, because real grief never does. It's heartbreak and gratitude. It's sorrow and love. It's remembering and missing. It's laughing through tears because somebody tells a story that your uncle, that only he could tell. It's standing in a sanctuary with your family, singing words that you've sung your entire life, only to realize that they have never meant as much as they do right in that moment. Maybe that's why those old hymns continue to endure, not because they're familiar, but because they give voice to hope. Without demanding that sorrow leaves the room, they remind us that faith doesn't erase grief. Faith just simply refuses to let grief have the final word. And after that last hymn is sung and the final prayer is offered, something else begins. The cars line up, the headlights stretch down the winding mountain road. People who never knew the family quietly pull their vehicles to the side and wait. It's a tradition. We've practiced it for generations, but most of us have never stopped to ask why. But I think the answer reveals one of the most profound psychological truths about grief is every healthy goodbye needs a journey. Every goodbye needs a journey. And there's a moment at every funeral that often goes unnoticed. Not because it isn't important, but because we've done it for so long that we've stopped asking why. The service is over. Family members leave the church or the funeral home and they climb into their cars. The hearse pulls onto the road one by one. The cars fall in behind it, right? The headlights stretch out like a ribbon winding through these mountains. And then something beautiful happens, right? I already mentioned it. People driving in the opposite direction, they begin pulling to the side of the road. I've seen construction workers stop what they're doing and remove their hard hats, right? For just a few moments, an entire community quietly acknowledges that someone is making one final journey home. And if you grew up here, you probably never questioned it. It's just what we do. But have you ever wondered why? Why do complete strangers stop for someone they've never met? Why has this tradition endured for generations? And it's about respect, but I don't think it's just about respect. I think it's about something deeper. Because like I said earlier, grief isn't only emotional. Grief is transitional. And in a single moment, life is divided into two chapters. There was the life before this death, and there's the life after it. And the problem is our hearts don't always know how to move from one chapter to the next. And you'll hear psychologists sometimes talk about the importance of transitions. And as human beings, we simply don't wake up one morning completely adjusted to these major life changes. We need markers, right? That's why we have graduations and weddings and birthday parties and anniversaries. These moments help our minds recognize that something significant has changed, and death is no different. In fact, because death is permanent, The transition may even be more important. The funeral procession becomes a bridge. It allows families to physically travel the same through that same transition that they're beginning emotionally. Notice something interesting, okay? The family, they don't leave the funeral home separately, right? They leave together. The community doesn't scatter in all different directions. They travel together. Nobody races behind. Races ahead. Nobody gets left behind. Everyone moves at the same pace. And it's always, you know, I've always thought that there's something incredibly comforting about that. Because isn't that what grief asks of us? Not to rush. Don't pretend we're okay. Just keep moving forward, 1 mile at a time, one curve at a time, one breath at a time. And somehow, having others travel beside us makes that journey a little less frightening. And here in the mountains, funeral processions often pass places that held pieces of a person's life. The church that they worshiped at, the school where they graduated, the store where they shopped, where they stopped and got coffee every morning, the road where they taught their kids to drive. So without anyone saying a word, the journey itself quietly tells a story. This is where they lived. This is where they belonged. This community was part of their life, and they were a part of ours. And then we arrive at the cemetery, and if I'm honest, I think this is the moment many families dread the most. Everything leading up to this point has carried a sense of togetherness, right? The visitation, the service, singing, profession. It's all about togetherness. But standing beside the grave, now there is an unmistakable awareness that something is changing. For many people, this moment, when this is the moment, that's the moment when the reality of the loss settles in with a new weight. I've heard families say, I was okay until we got to the cemetery. And that makes perfect sense to me, because the graveside service represents something every healthy ritual eventually has to do. It gently says this chapter has to come to an end. Now, before you misunderstand me, let me say something important. The relationship hasn't ended. The love hasn't ended. The memories certainly haven't ended. But this chapter, the chapter where we could pick up the phone and hear their voice and hold their hand, that chapter has ended. And painful as that truth is, our hearts eventually need a place to acknowledge it. That's one reason why I think simple acts that we perform at the graveside matter so much. Like a granddaughter placing a rose on the casket, or a son tossing in a handful of dirt, or a military flag being folded, a final prayer, a last hymn. None of those actions change what has happened, but they change how we carry it. And psychologists have learned something important about human beings when we're facing something that we cannot control. Having something to do, having something meaningful to do, often helps us move through it. Now think about that. Grief leaves us feeling helpless. We couldn't stop the illness. We couldn't stop the diagnosis. We couldn't prevent the accident. Death certainly reminds us of how little control we sometimes have. But placing a flower, offering a prayer, helping lower the casket, standing beside somebody we love, those small actions restore a little something that grief has taken away. They remind us that while we couldn't choose what happened, we still can choose how we respond to it. And perhaps that's one of the greatest gifts that the funeral ritual offers. They transform helplessness into love that's expressed. Not because the love changes the outcome, but because love always needs somewhere to go. Then, almost quietly, the family leaves the cemetery. And if you've ever been a part of an Appalachian funeral, you know exactly, you know what usually happens next, right? When it's when the cemetery committal is over, someone smiles and gently says, "Come on over to the church and get something to eat." To someone unfamiliar with our traditions, that invitation may seem almost out of place. After all, who thinks about food after burying someone they love? But as it turns out, our mountain communities understands something very profound. Sometimes the first step toward rebuilding life begins around a kitchen table. And that has to do with learning to live again. So, like I said, if you've ever attended an Appalachian funeral, you know exactly what's going to happen after everybody leaves the cemetery. Y'all come on over to the fellowship hall. We've got food over there at the church. Don't go home yet. Come eat with us. And I've always loved that invitation because on the surface it seems almost ordinary, right? People sit around folding tables, paper plates, plastic forks, bowls of soup, beans, cornbread, fried chicken, ham, and green beans, and homemade pies and banana pudding for sure. They're recipes that's been passed down for generations. But it looks like a meal, but I don't think it's about the meal at all. Most grieving families will tell you they couldn't remember what they ate that day, or some can't even tell you if they've eaten at all. So why do we keep doing it? Because once again, mountain communities understood something that psychology is just now putting into words. Grief disrupts life, not just emotionally, but practically. And the simplest routines suddenly become difficult. You forget to eat. You lose track of time. You can't remember whether you took your medicine. You find yourself standing in the kitchen wondering, why did I walk in here? Your entire world feels unfamiliar. And then somebody hands you a plate. Not because they're trying to solve your grief, but because just for a few minutes, they are quietly helping you live your life again. They are quietly helping your life begin again. It's a remarkable gentle act. No one ever says, "Today we're rebuilding your sense of normal." Right? Nobody says that. They simply ask, "Would you like some more cornbread? You want some more brown beans?" And somehow that simple act begins reminding your nervous system that life, although it has forever changed, it's still moving. And healing doesn't happen because we stop hurting. Healing begins little by little. Life starts asking us to participate again. One conversation, one shared meal, one sunrise, one step at a time. And as both a funeral director and a psychologist, I've had the privilege of walking with families during some of those dark, dark days. And if there's one thing those experiences have taught me, it's that people are far more resilient than they realize. Not because grief isn't devastating, because it is. Not because love fades away, because it doesn't. But because human beings have an incredible capacity to carry both sorrow and hope at the same time. And I've seen widows who thought they would never smile again laugh at a story their grandson told. Right, I've watched children run through the fellowship hall completely unaware that they were reminding adults that life continues on. And I've seen families who've walked into a funeral home believing they could never survive this loss somehow discover that months later that they hadn't moved on, but they had moved forward. And there's an important difference there. I don't like the phrase "moving on" because to me, it sounds like leaving somebody behind. And grief isn't about leaving people behind. It's about learning how to carry them differently. And one of the gifts that psychology has given us over the past several decades is the permission to stop thinking about grief as something that we're supposed to finish, There isn't a finish line with grief. There isn't a day when we wake up and we just announce, well, I guess I'm done grieving now. Love does not work that way. Instead, we slowly learn to weave that love into something new, a new life, a life where birthdays still matter and anniversaries still brings tears and a favorite song still catches us off guard, where we still tell Papa's stories at Thanksgiving and make Mama's biscuits, right? Exactly the way she did. And that's not because that we're stuck, but because love continues to shape who we are. And maybe that's what funerals have been helping us do all along. Not helping us let go, but helping us hold on in healthy ways. Helping us remember, helping us honor, helping us begin. So before we close, I want to leave you with something that I think I'm going to call a moment to consider. Okay? So think way back to a funeral that has stayed with you. Not because everything went perfect and not because somebody gave this unforgettable sermon, but because something about the day helped your heart breathe a little easier. And maybe it was that neighbor sitting beside of you, or the sound of your church singing, or stories that were shared, or seeing how many people came because the person had touched their lives in so many ways. Now, ask yourself this question. When you get that funeral in your mind that stayed with you, ask yourself, what need was being met at that moment? Was it your need to know that the death was real? Your need to feel less alone? Your need to remember? Your need to express emotions that you couldn't yet put into words? Or your need for hope? Sometimes that we think healing comes from one extraordinary moment. And most often, it comes through dozens of ordinary moments that quietly remind us you don't have to walk this road alone. So as we finish today, I hope you'll remember something that I believe with all my heart. Funerals were never simply created to honor the dead. They were created to care for the living. Long before we understood grief through brain imaging and attachment theory and psychological research, families instinctively gathered around one another. They brought food, they sang, they prayed, they cried, they laughed, they told stories, they walked together to the cemetery. Right? What modern psychology has discovered is something that Appalachian communities have practiced for generations. And I love that. Healing doesn't happen because grief disappears. Healing happens because love is witnessed, because short stories are shared, because burdens are carried together, because no one has to face the impossible alone. That's why funeral rituals matter, not because they're old traditions, but because they're deeply human. So the next episode of Bailey's Bridges, I think we're going to explore another question that almost every grieving person eventually asks, and it's, why do the questions that come after loss sometimes hurt more than the answers? So I'm thinking that's where we're going to go. Thank you so much for joining me on Bailey's Bridges for the first episode ever. I hope this grows, and ultimately I hope it continues to meet the community's wants and needs. So until next time, remember, keep building bridges, have the courage to remember, have the strength to grieve, and the hope to keep moving forward. See you next time.